Welcome back, everybody, to the Reflex Blue Show. I'm your host, Donovan Beery, recording from the How Design Live conference. And we have with us one of the attendees, Nikita Prokhorov. And I know I got that half wrong.
No, you actually got it full right. So well okay. Done.
I will try not to repeat it again. And you said it's actually a Russian name. Are you from Russia?
Born and raised for the first 10 years of my life and the next 27 and hopefully more in the United States.
And you're in New York City.
New York City.
Independent designer, and you are known for ambigrams.
Yep, I'm known for ambigrams, for better or for worse.
And I started teaching up again, and actually it was the last class, so just Thursday. One of the assignments that they set up is all the students have to report on, you know, find a graphic design article or something design related. And in the most recent issue of How Magazine, my student pulled it open and I was like, Nikita! And shockingly enough, you wrote an article on ambigrams. Very well done, by the way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
What is it that... For those who don't know, an ambigram is a word that can be read when right side up, and then you flip it, and it actually can be the same word or different words when you flip it.
Yep. There's different kinds of ambigrams. There's the most common rotational one where you turn the word 180 degrees, and it's the same word. There's a symbiotogram. It's an unofficial name, but based on the word symbiote, so when you turn it upside down, it's a different word. You can have reflective ambigrams, which you put it next to a mirror, it's read differently. You can have 90-degree rotational ambigrams, which you only turn 90 degrees to read another word. There's so many variations, and it just evolves constantly.
So these are all ambigrams, but then they're different words inside of ambigrams, so of what it could be.
Yep.
What made you fascinated with this? Like, what brought you into say, like, hey, this is what I want to dedicate my spare time to, is doing ambigrams?
Well, I've always been drawn to art. It makes you go back and take a second or a third look. Work like M.C. Escher, René Magritte, most surrealists in general. And when I first read the book Angels and Demons by Dan Brown, ambigrams were an integral part of the plot. So I started reading the book. I got to page, I don't know, 15, 20, and there was a first ambigram, and I stopped reading the book because I couldn't believe that something like this exists.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there in Barnes & Noble, or I think it was Borders, and turning the book upside down, trying to figure out how to do this. I already have a sketch pad and pencils out, trying to sketch out my first ambigram, which was so ridiculously awful. We'll probably never see the light of day. But in the end, I actually never finished the book before I actually drew my first ambigram. And after I drew it, then I finished the book, and then I looked at the other ambigrams in the plot, and they were just fantastic. So that's how I got involved in them.
And it is one of those things where I do know they made a resurgence, like they started making back into the pop culture because they were in a heavily publicized book. And it was even in the movie poster and such for it.
They're also very... Ambigrams are very popular in the tattoo culture. There's a certain black letter gothic style that is very popular. I don't know if it's because it's easier to read or it's more ambiguous and that makes it easier to perceive or understand, or just because it's easier to tattoo, but it's one of the most common trends.
Or because it just looks cool?
It looks very cool, and if I was ever to get a tattoo, it would be my own ambigram. And I don't know if it would be black letter or gothic, but it would be some kind of ambigram that I designed, but I haven't gotten to that point yet.
And you've even written a book on ambigrams, too, if I recall right.
Yep. It was a book, and I didn't so much write the whole thing. I obviously wrote an introduction, wrote parts of some of the section, the tips and tricks, but it's not just a book that I wrote. It's a book of case studies in ambigrams. There's a showcase of ambigrams. There's a panel of judges, which two of them are the pioneers of ambigrams, John Langdon and Scott Kim. There's Robert Petrick, who's also one of the pioneers, and they all... I kind of started ambigrams, the whole movement, if you will, back in the late 70s. And John Langdon and Scott Kim, they worked ambigrams independently from the East Coast and the West Coast. And then they got together and so they realized, oh, yeah, we're working on the same idea. We just called it different names. So Scott Kim called it inversions, and he still calls them that. And John Langdon and everybody else calls them ambigrams. So there's kind of a dual name for it, which is ironic because ambigrams are very dual-natured. So.
No, that makes sense. And in your company, where do people go to find out more about your company and your work before we talk a bit further here?
Well, my company is essentially, you know, sitting right in front of you. It's me. Since I'm a freelancer, I work out of, you know, coffee shops, my apartment. You know, I freelance outside for companies. You can go to either nikitaprokhorov.com, and I'll spell that for you. It's nikitaprokhorov.com. Or if you go to ambigrams.com, which is the website for all my ambigrams, it's... Let me see if I can remember how to spell this. It's ambigramist.com. And that features all my Amgram work. The other website is more traditional design portfolio. This is nothing but Amgrams.
What is it that makes you continue to want to do this work? Because this is a specialized market. Even though it is, there is like a niche to it, it's very specialized. What is it that makes you continue to stay in the Amgram world?
Well, it's fun. It's when you sit down and try to solve an Amgram, you have the solution, but you don't know how to get to it. So the whole fun of the process trying to figure out.
Because the solution is you have the word or words.
Yeah. You know that you need to make this word read the same way upside down, but figuring out how, that's a challenge. And I guess it's the same. It's a bit different from traditional design work, let's say creating a logo, because you don't know which way your exploration, your brainstorming, your conceptual stage can take you. In Amgram design, I mean, the style is not determined yet, but you know the end result. So you kind of have a puzzle, you just need to figure out the puzzle pieces.
That's fantastic. We'll be right back with Nikita. Now before we continue here, you actually do other design work as well. This isn't the only thing that you work on.
Yes, I actually have a traditional design portfolio. I love to work on a logo, custom typography, hand lettering, you know, branding, packaging. So I do some more, a lot of the more traditional design projects when I get a chance to.
And I would assume that most people who work in Amgrams probably are good at hand lettering. Like, I assume it's a skill that translates back and forth. If you can do Amgrams, you can probably do lettering.
You know, it's funny because when I started getting into the Amgram field, if you will, if you can even call it a field, and I started getting to know artists, two of the guys I know, they're engineers, and they do amazing Amgrams. One guy that I know, he works at the American Museum of Natural History. He works in archaeology. He's a curator there, and he creates Amgrams in his spare time. And he's not a graphic designer, but he's a very creative person, which enables him to do it. And for me, Amgrams overlap. I started learning about custom lettering, hand lettering, and Amgrams together, so to speak. I didn't get into custom lettering until a few years after graduate school, and I realized that I had this epiphany. Hey, you can draw your own letters. You don't just have to modify existing typefaces. It was like this epiphany, this light bulb went off over my head. So, and at the same time, I realized that Amgrams exist, so I kind of learned about it too. It definitely helps if you have some experience about, you know, with custom, with hand lettering, because Amgrams are just type manipulations. I mean, at the core of it, you still have to follow the core principles of typography, about typeface design, about consistency in the typeface. It's just a whole different level of manipulation.
Yeah, it still has to look like a letter A. It just has to be able to be flipped around and then look like a letter P.
Yeah, that's essentially it. And you still have to follow all the traditional rules. You have to watch the weights of the typefaces, the contrast in thicks and thins. You know, that's why it's a general recommendation. You never use an existing typeface to create an Amgram, because you're already kind of locked into a set of constraints. It's better to start really raw and really out there and then slowly narrow down your options and figure out what's the best until, you know, you chipped away all the necessary items.
Do you normally start with, like, the easiest parts, or do you start with the difficult part? Like are there certain letters that just don't flip well?
Yeah, I haven't found a good way to turn a Z into an O upside down, and I don't think that's ever going to work.
Z's do not turn into O's.
No, they do not turn into O's, and Y's don't turn into A's either.
So
Y can actually turn into an A, but Z's definitely don't turn into O's.
So doing an Amgram for the word zoo is like a nightmare.
It's not a nightmare, because if there's a will, there's a way, and when you can't do a traditional approach where you can turn one letter upside down and make it turn into another letter, you get creative. And it's all about context as well, because, you know, obviously, like in regular typography, the way you perceive letters, it's, and whether you read the word and understand the word, it depends on the surrounding elements, you know, the space around the letters, the letters next to them. And if you take certain parts of the neighboring letter into account, maybe you can make that Z-O work, where if it's just independent letters, you couldn't do it.
What was the first time you ran into a problem that you solved with an Amgram, where you're like, hey, I didn't think this was possible? Was there certain letters that just clicked, just took a while? Or how do you, does this involve just a lot of sketching, or is there a lot more research involved?
You know, just like any design project, when you're trying to figure out a solution, trying to come up with a concept, it's all research and exploration and sketching. You know, there's some projects, some Amgrams I've done where I go back to them 6 months later. I couldn't make it work before. I go back to it 6 months later because something clicked in my mind and I saw a combination of traditional letters, or I was working a different ambigram and cell potential approach, and I go back and it works. Some ambigrams I worked on and I've abandoned them because they just don't work. And I have probably 400 or 500 of those somewhere tucked away in sketchbooks all over my apartment. So the challenge with ambigrams is knowing when to step away and say, this doesn't work. Because not every word can turn into ambigram, and not every word can turn into a good ambigram, which is very important.
And so if somebody comes up and they say, we got a logo we want to make into an ambigram, is it one of those, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work?
It's absolutely one of those scenarios, and more so when people come to me, when clients come to me, potential clients, and ask me, hey, I have this company, I want to make my company logo an ambigram, I usually try to dissuade them from that, because a company logo, it has to be perceived and understood 100% by everyone across the board. If you're selling laundry detergent and your logo looks like a letter from the industrial era, you don't get that softness, that comfort level across.
Sure.
So same with an ambigram. It's not just identifiable logo for a company. It has to be read and perceived 100%. And it's very hard to do with an ambigram, especially a good ambigram. So most of the time when somebody asks for a logo for their company as an ambigram, I try to dissuade them from that, unless I look at the name and it's a short name and I can see that it has potential and will be a good ambigram. Like the company Expedex, spelled X-P-E-D-X, that's almost a natural ambigram, and the company merged with another one a few years ago, but their logo is a perfect example of an ambigram that's easily read and understood across the board. You look at it, there's no mistaking what it is.
Yeah, and I can even, with those letters, I'm like, yeah, I could flip a P into a D pretty quick.
Yeah.
I can probably do that with an existing font typeface.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, there's some combinations that are just natural. Like you flip a B upside down, lowercase b, it becomes a Q. You know, if it's not exactly a Q, you do some slight tweaking to the letter, and that's where the traditional typography knowledge comes into play. But some ambigrams, like I said, some letter combinations just lend themselves towards working, and some just don't work no matter how long you try to make them work.
Now, have you done the other where you're doing a logo for somebody and you said this would make a great ambigram and convince them of it? Like, has that ever happened, or are you still waiting for that one?
It's happened, but it mostly happens internally on my sketchbook and on my table at home. If I see a logo that works in ambigram, I try not to push in that direction because it opens up a whole set of potential pitfalls. So if we're working a traditional logo and I have an icon and a word mark solution, I usually just leave it at that.
But sometimes
I just share it with a client after, just for the heck of it, just to, if they want to use it as a promotional item, like a sticker, or embroidery, or in a cup, sometimes I share it with them and they love it. Sometimes I say it's great, but it's too out there, too far out there, which is fine. It's a response I get from quite a few clients about ambigrams, and that's completely acceptable.
Or I think it makes them look like the Illuminati. that was the one ambigram in the Angels and Demons, right? The Illuminati.
Yep. That was one of the main ambigrams that represented the secret society. And some people love that dark, mysterious feeling, and some people don't want it. So I just let them have their peace of mind.
Sure, sure. All right. Well, we're going to be right back with Nikita. So you're in New York right now, Nikita.
Yes, I am.
Have you been back to Russia? You said you left when you were 10?
Yes, I left in 89, and I haven't been back since, because we have a very small family. It was my mom, my grandma, my grandpa, and they moved over here within the span of 2 years. So by now,
yeah, when you were 10, you weren't in on the decision making. You were just taken with them. Like,
yeah, I was.
We're moving, and you're like, okay. It wasn't like I'm going to stay here. I'm in like fifth grade. I'll just hang out with my buds.
Yeah, I'm going to stay here and work in the mines and have a bottle of vodka every day. No, no, I didn't get a chance to stay. I was pretty much went where I was told. So my mom and I moved here in '89. Then my grandparents moved 2 years later in '91. And that was pretty much the whole family. There's some cousins that are spread out all over the world. I have my grandfather had a twin brother, and his granddaughter lives in Canada. We touch base once in a while. Very, very cool person. And that's about it. We have a tiny family. So.
Well, you were old enough to remember, obviously, living there. Like you probably have a lot of memories from the area.
You know,
does any of that help with like your design? Do you think back about how things are visual? Because I know like when we travel, it helped. You know, having different visual things to play off of and different experiences really kind of can build in what we do now. Does having that experience of growing up in Russia affect what you do as a designer?
Oh, it's funny you say that, because back when I was 10 and I had to move here, I was so preoccupied with assimilating to the culture, learning the language, which was difficult even though I went to an English teaching school in Russia. I think our teacher didn't know more than 500 words. So when I moved here,
well, that's 200 more than in any Dr. Seuss book. So I think you're set.
Well, I knew how to say my name is Nikita and where's the bathroom, even though it was a horrible English language, horrible accent that got me through the first 15 years of my life or so. And then when I was old enough and I started, you know, reading back about Russian culture, and thankfully my grandparents and my mom, they very artistic, very educated people. They've taken me to a lot of Russian musicals, Russian museums. So I had that base. And when I started growing up, I got interested in graphic design. I was able to tap into that culture and those roots and learn about Russian art, Russian propaganda, which influenced my design for quite a long time. Not just the traditional red and gray and black color palette, but also...
Oh, but we love Russian constructivism.
Oh, we love propaganda, Russian constructivism. Good. Absolutely. You need, what, a type of bold industrial typeface, red and black, and you're done.
Sometimes you move it to kind of an orangish.
A yellow. I'm sorry, I forgot the yellow.
Yeah, sometimes, and then you're done for another year.
And a hammer and sickle. Throw that in there. A bottle of vodka. Maybe an illustration of a bear with a furry ushanka, which is a traditional Russian hat, and you're done.
Now you're limiting your audience a little bit. You can't really sell that to IBM as well, but. But, you know, but yeah, that's the idea.
But if you embroider the IBM logo on the hat and the bear has a maybe IBM tattoo on the paw, that's perfect.
Bring it right back. I love it.
Absolutely. No, but I love my Russian roots, Russian culture, now that I'm able to explore it further. Because, like I said, when I moved here and I was 10, I was too busy acclimating to a completely different culture. And, of course, being Russian in an American society, I got tons of flack for being Russian, accents, the nicknames came into play. That was hilarious.
That was the era where that culture would be heavily stereotyped here in America.
Oh, absolutely. And I think having moved here at the time, I got the brunt of it. For example, my junior year in high school, our history teacher, the last day before spring break, he said, "We're going to have a movie day." And we were all very excited with the movie will be. He brought in Red Dawn. And, of course, I didn't hear about that for the rest of the year. It was awful.
Yeah, you got Red Dawn, you got Rocky IV.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And what really gets to me, when you look up on the Russian stereotype in movies, it's always about 6'3", 6'4", blonde hair, blue eyes, big muscles, and then I'm 5'8", brunette, and I turned to my mom and dad and said, "Mom, Dad, what happened? Why didn't you give me the stereotypical look and feel?" I'm like, "All right, not our fault. You work with what you've been given."
Why don't I look like Dolph Lundgren?
I can do the accent. I can do the accent, but I lack the height, the muscles, and the kickboxing skills and the punching power. But yeah. I got the accent down. That's all that it needs to get me through the day sometimes.
Yeah, and Russia's a very large country. It's not like small. It's very big. So what part of Russia were you from? Did you actually come from?
Well, I was born and raised in Moscow, so right in the heart of the motherland, as they would say.
Okay.
Just 10 years there, and I remember the area where we lived really well. And when I close my eyes, I can picture the playground, I can picture the apartment building, and my grandparents lived in the third floor. My dad and my mom and I lived in the first floor, so it was very integrated. You know, this is a time where I was 6 years old. They could give me some money and send me to the corner store for groceries, like bread and milk, and I could just walk out there and do it. I don't think you can do that anymore in that neighborhood, not because it's gotten bad, but because it's changed so much.
Sure. And that's great. I mean, it's great when you have these experiences, and it's great for design when we have people in the profession that have all these experiences, because we've talked on the show before that it's that all cultures help, because you're going to come up with different solutions just by living there, even though you're now obviously you've been here for way longer than you were there, but you never forget your first few years.
No, you don't. And actually, if you're interested in design-related story that overlaps with Russian roots and sort of a negative part of it, I can quickly elaborate.
Sure, because not in design, not all things are positive, not all things are negative.
Absolutely.
Most things are actually in between.
Yeah, some of there's a purgatory between positive and negative. So when I was in grad school and I actually started really getting passionate about design, started developing a logo for myself, my first thought was, okay, let me use a red star. It's associated with Russian culture, Russian roots. So I took a red star, I put my name next to it, and I think it was Future Bold, and I was happy.
Sure.
Showed that logo to my mom and my grandma, and the excrement hit the proverbial fan.
Oh.
And I asked them, well, what is the problem? Why are you reacting like this? And it didn't dawn on me that I could be wrong or they would be right. I just thought that my design was perfect and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Well, then they started to give me a little history lesson about the Russian rulers and Russian politics back then. They gave me a little history of our family and how many family members actually suffered in Russian concentration camps and how some of them were killed. And they basically enlightened me with the fact that the little Red Star, which is so popular, and, you know, Heineken, Macy's, you know, countless other companies use it.
Right.
It's associated actually with a very bloody regime that killed, you know, thousands and thousands of not just intelligent people, but smart people, bright people, people that would have made a huge difference had they survived. Not even counting just our family members, you know, in general. So then I realized that, hey, that's actually probably not a good symbol to associate yourself with. So then I designed a new logo for myself, and my professor at the time, Scott Boylston, in grad school, he encouraged me to write an article about it. So I did some more history research. I wrote an article, and it was actually featured in How Magazine in 2006 or 2000's promotional issue. So I designed my new logo, and then, of course, someone said, hey, it looks like Milton Glaser's logo. So I looked it up, and, of course, it looked very much like Milton Glaser's logo. So I went from a rock to a hard place.
Well, I mean, if you're gonna be caught looking like someone, your mom probably wouldn't care if you copied Milton Glaser, but she does care if you copied.
She does care if I associated my design work and myself, having been raised in Russia, with something very negative out of the country's history. And I actually, it was a great learning process, and this is one of the great examples for design all across the board. You're trying to represent a culture or certain type of people with your design, or you're trying to appeal to certain type of people. Learn a little bit about the culture. Take the time to explore and read. Ask someone who's part of that culture. You know, if you're designing for a market that's located in Asia, talk to someone, do some research, figure out what's in terms of color, in terms of typefaces, because there's color opposites in our culture versus, you know, in Asia, for example, you know, the whole black and white thing. And, you know, in our culture, white is a color of happiness, purity, and innocence. Black is dark color. It symbolizes death and negativity. Well, in our culture, it's backwards. So, bottom line, when you're designing for a different culture, learn about the aspects of the culture before you dive into it head first.
Yeah, if you would have done a green star, they wouldn't have cared until you saw someone who was red-green colorblind, and then they'd be all mad, and you'd be like, what?
And then I would be out of business completely, yes, absolutely. Nobody would know what I do.
Now, you did do the right thing. You showed it to your mom, who obviously knew more about the culture before you threw it out everywhere. So in a way, you kind of... And which reminds me, I think one of the things you mentioned in your Ambigram article that was in the most recent How magazine was you said to show your stuff to multiple people. Yep. And it was, I assume it's not so that they'll tell you that your Ambigram reminds them of death. I assume it's so they can tell you, once you get into Ambigram so much, I assume like you can read a lot more convoluted things that barely even look like letter forms because you get so into it. And I assume you're doing that so that can the regular person make out what these letters are.
Oh, absolutely. In any design process, when we get too close with a project and we're involved with it constantly, we tend to lose perspective. And when I look at even traditional, somewhat traditional design work, and I think it's really awful or I think it's really great, which is not a good mindset either, yeah. I show it to some people and some fellow designers, and they either take me back down to earth, chop my ego down to size, or they tell me it's actually pretty good, where I think it's absolute garbage. So it helps to get a different perspective when you get too close to a project, you know, regardless whether it's an ambigram or poster or book design, because sometimes you lose that objectivity if you're too close and you're involved in it for a long period of time.
No, that's wonderful. Well, Nikita, we really thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's been my
pleasure.
Enjoy
the How conference and seeing everybody here. It's great to finally actually meet you.
I know, for a couple of years, it's great to meet face to face and chat informally and formally.
And you've been very active in the Howies group, so like you, it seems like you know a lot of people at How, but I mean, I haven't seen you at How since I've been here.
Well, I'm very active online in the How group and on the forum back then when it was a good, really good forum. I haven't been able to get to too many conferences, and when I do, it's with usually 3 or 4 years in between. So it feels like I go to one conference and I miss the excitement, I go to another conference and I miss some more excitement in a few years. So, but it's nice to catch up and put a face to the name and chat and get to know you a little bit.
And I assume that you're active on the forums or the Howie boards or now the group that they have, because being a solo designer, which I basically am as well, it's your way to stay connected and with the community.
Yeah, if I can think of one drawback to being a solo designer is the fact you don't get that in-office environment or in-company, in-house feel. You don't get to socialize as much. You can't just turn around and tap your colleague on the shoulder and say, hey, what do you think of this? So it helps to stay active because some of the connections you make are for decades and decades to come. And some folks I've met, I've known them for 10-plus years. And ironically, some of them I've known for 10 years before I even met them face-to-face. So it's like you cultivate a friendship, and then finally you meet in person, and you just pick up where you left off online. So that's the beauty of it. You still make those connections, whether it's in person or online.
And for those of you who actually pay attention show to show, Bill Gardner is not actually on this episode. He will be on the next one. So we will also ask Nikita, do you have any question for Bill of Logo Lounge that we can ask him just on anything whatsoever?
Yeah, how do you consistently put out such fantastic work?
Oh, no, I can't. I don't know if I can ask him that. I don't know if I can ask him that one. Come on. Bill's been on the show before. We can't give him that big of a softball. You got anything else?
All right. Well, put me on the spot off the top of my head. What is the worst and the best submission you've ever received? You don't have to give names, just general description.
Sounds great. That I'll ask him.
All right, fantastic.
Thanks, Nikita.
Thanks.
The Reflex Blue Show with Donovan Beery is hosted at 36point.com. Music by Dustlab. Find out more at myspace.com/dustlab.